I would turn the proceedings over to Glenn Lorbecki and his book, Power Tools for Pro Tools 10.
Thank you. Thank me. No. Hey, everybody. Thanks for coming out tonight. I know you had lots of other options for what to do. There's a big advocacy meeting, a bunch of people going to Olympia to talk about the opportunity to dance tax. Which if you haven't heard about it before, you should probably look into, because your favorite eatery or drinkery within the city limits of Seattle is now liable to pay a tax if there's any chance that dancing might take place on their premises.
Spontaneous.
Yeah. Official or otherwise. And sorry to start out with a big advocacy thing, but this is an important thing. And had I not been here tonight with you lovely people, I would have been in Olympia talking to our legislators about this very issue. Suffice it to say, if you're a fan of live music, this is something you should look into and try to help defeat. I'm a member of the Recording Academy, and the Recording Academy has gotten really involved in these advocacy issues over the years. Just out of curiosity, we saw how many folks are AES members. How many folks belong to the Recording Academy? Okay. That's cool. A good bunch. I always felt like AES and the Recording Academy were really great partners, and that one organization helped the other, and that the combination of our two groups together was stronger than either could possibly be separately. So if you aren't currently a member of AES or the Recording Academy, I strongly suggest that you look into it for networking issues and advocacy issues and so on and so forth. And if you have any questions about the Recording Academy, I'm happy to answer those later. That's not why I'm here to talk today. About a year ago, hey, welcome aboard.
Come on in.
Hey, how are you? Applauso. Oh. I'd like to conduct the next part of this meeting in Spanish. But I can't. How many of you, I'm going to ask a bunch of questions first, just so that I get a feel for what you folks do. How many in the room are students currently? All the student of life does not count, Steve. How many of you folks are professionals, professional recording people? Okay. How many of you own Pro Tools? Wow. Okay. How many of you either are looking to get Pro Tools or are really, really new at it? Okay. All right. This is a pretty... last question. How many of you have had more than 5 years of experience on Pro Tools? How many of you have had more than 5 years experience on any workstation? Okay, so we've got some digitally literate people in the crowd. This is going to be an interesting challenge for me because I usually work with folks that are either new to Pro Tools or folks that are really experienced in Pro Tools, and this is going to be a good cross-section. So what I'm going to do is, rather than, you know, take it from square one and you know, try to invent the workstation before your very eyes, I'm going to do some overview stuff, and at which point you have a question, just shoot up your hand at any time and ask me, and we'll try to cover all of this stuff. If I get too far in the weeds on a subject, Rick Chin will remind... He's not even listening. Rick.
What?
I was just going to say, if I get too far in the weeds on a subject, just feel free to raise your hand and say move on.
Oh, okay.
So that I don't waste everyone's time.
So Rich has asked me, do we want the lights up for the presentation?
Down.
Or do you want them down?
Yeah.
Is there a halfway?
Well, I can show you what there is.
Okay.
You can decide whether it's halfway or not.
It's digital.
Yeah. I'd like something a little more romantic.
No dancing.
Right. No dancing. Well, we are north of...
Close your eyes.
It doesn't work.
Yeah. If this gets too loud, just cover your ears and run screaming from the room. I'll take that as a hint. Let's start at the beginning. Pro Tools. A little over a year ago, the fine folks at Hal Leonard came to me and they said, you teach Pro Tools, don't you? And I said, well, yeah, we have a school called Digify, and we teach the professional certification classes for Pro Tools. And we've been doing that for about 5 or 6 years. And they said, oh, well, then you probably know what you're talking about with Pro Tools. And I said, well, to a certain extent, I do, but I'm always willing to learn more. And they said, great, you're the perfect person to write the new Pro Tools book. So they showed me the old version of this, the Pro Tools 8 book that they had done. Oh, apparently I'm still getting... Okay. Sorry, this will just take a moment. They said, we would like you to update this thing, but we want a little different slant on it. There's already a ton of books out there that talk about this menu and that menu and this keystroke does that, and if you know, run through all of the menu options, and I think that's just great. If any of you have the PDF of the main Pro Tools manual, it kind of does that in a very thorough way. However, whenever I look through that, my eyes glaze in about 30 seconds, and I can't remember any of the stuff I'm supposed to remember, and I certainly can't use any of it. So they came to me and said, can we do something that's a little more practical? Can we do something that, yes, it will go through the menu options and the keystrokes and the secret shortcuts, but can you also present it in such a way that people who actually work on the thing for a living can figure out how to do what they want to do? And we started talking about it, and I said, well, you know, in Pro Tools, there's 5 ways to do whatever it is you want to do. And they went, yeah, like that. So show people the 5 ways, and then they will gravitate toward the 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 that they use the most often, or that works best for their workflow, or that's easiest for them. So I said, okay, that's the approach I'll take. So it took me about 1.5 years to write 3 books for Hal Leonard. I started with mixing and mastering in Pro Tools, recording instruments and vocals in Pro Tools, and then finished with this, which is the Pro Tools 10 version of all of those books. So this is sort of a compilation of all of the work that I had done prior to that. So if you're going to buy one of the books, or if you're looking for something that you can keep on your desk next to your Pro Tools rig and have like little sticky notes on pages, this is a pretty cool thing. That's how I use books. I like to have it handy so that I can reference things while I'm working. But in addition to that, I created a website that has some additional materials. Oh, those are the books. Whee! And so it's called Pro Tools on the Web. This is my little QR code. If you guys want to snap a picture of it or do a scan, this will take you right to the website that I have that has some additional information. It has a compendium of all of the shortcut keystrokes. It has all of the error codes listed. And it has some other interesting stuff, a frequency response chart. And it also has a link to a free version of Pro Tools. So if you don't already own Pro Tools, they've got a 30-day trial demo version on the Avid website. What's that?
I've tried that, and it always takes you to a page that won't come up.
Oh, really? I tested it last night. Yeah, I
many times in the last 3 weeks.
Are you on a PC or a Mac?
Mac.
Ew. Do you have internet?
Well, I got to the first page where it said they had a free punch here for a free 30-day trial.
Yeah.
Can't get there. It just goes to a unable to load the page.
Oh, that's odd. Because there's a form on the right-hand side of the page, and you fill in the form, and then it takes you to the download page, and that doesn't work for you. Odd. Okay. Well, if for some reason more of you have similar problems, I'm gonna test it again, Everett, when I get home tonight.
This is just my world. This is my digital world. Every day.
I'm sorry. We're gonna make that better for you today. Yeah. If you want to jot down my email, I'm happy to give you guys insight in some of this stuff. But it's Glenn, GLENN, at glennsound, GLENNSOUND.com. And
not Glenn at Glenn Glenson.
I wish. I wish they'd buy me. Okay. I'm for sale. Pro Tools 10 started out, it was kind of a surprise to a lot of folks because Pro Tools 9 had only been out for 1 year, and at AES 2011, they went, ta-da, and they released a pretty new version of Pro Tools called Pro Tools 10. Now, for people who've been following the Pro Tools platform for a long, long time, it wasn't a giant departure. But for people who do specific jobs, like post-production, for example, it was enormous. It was a really amazing upgrade. So they felt like they were going to get on a track where they were going to do a whole number release every year. Well, that lasted exactly a year. AES 2012 came and went, and there was no new version, and we were all kind of sitting around going, where is it? And they said, it's not ready yet. There's a lot of new stuff coming out. In fact, Pro Tools 11, we're not quite sure exactly when it'll be released, but they're doing beta testing beginning in March. So stay tuned for that. And contact, in fact, pester your local dealers, Brian, to find out when they're going to release Pro Tools 11. But in the meantime, Pro Tools 10 has turned out to be a really rock-solid platform for people who are a little bit afraid to go to Pro Tools 9, maybe even a little bit afraid to go to Pro Tools 8. I do a lot of work with the Grammy mix team during the Grammy telecast, and for years they were on 7.3 or 7.4. They wouldn't even go up to 8 because it just wasn't stable enough. This year they made the move to 10, and there were no problems throughout the whole show. I just came back from the Grammy telecast last week, and if any of you guys are interested in how Pro Tools is implemented, just shout out, and I can go through their setup and describe how they use multiple Pro Tools systems to accomplish the telecast mix. He said, waiting for takers.
Please do.
Let me get back to that, Steve, but first of all... here are some of the things I'd like to cover today, and if we don't get to them all, that's okay. But you know, I'll put up a couple of topics that I thought would be interesting to you all, and if I miss one of them, guide me back. Say, what about that thing that you said you were going to talk about that you promised? So I thought we could talk about generally an overview first. How to use it for composing? Not a lot of people do composing in Pro Tools, and we'll talk about that in a few minutes. Recording, obviously, you know, one of the strongest DAWs out there for recording and editing. My personal choice for mixing as well. There are people who use other workstations, but I think Pro Tools is one of the most powerful, and not just because I wrote the book. I had to buy my copy. It's not like I got it for free. Mastering. This isn't something that a lot of folks do. You don't master a whole record in Pro Tools because it's not really designed to do that. You can't do a lot of the stuff that Steve does in his desktop mastering, for example, Steve, the lovely and talented Steve Turnage. But it is good for prepping files for mastering, and so we'll talk about that a little bit. And finally, post-production. How many of you people are involved in post-production audio? Not a whole lot. Okay. All right, we won't spend a tremendous amount of time talking about it, but Pro Tools has turned into the workstation of choice for Hollywood types doing TV shows and films, and you'll probably hear me say this a number of times tonight, but one of the reasons Pro Tools has become so popular is because it has become so popular. It's ubiquitous. Remember NS10s? How many of you guys remember NS10s? Okay. These ugly little Yamaha speakers that you found in every single studio in the world. The reason everybody used them is because everybody used them. And you knew that if you went from Atlanta to New York to Chicago to Seattle, you would find the NS10 speakers in every single studio, which gave you a frame of reference, which allowed you to do your job more easily without having to waste a half a day getting used to other speakers. Well, Pro Tools is a lot the same way. If I start a session in my basement on just on my laptop, without using any external hardware, I can pick up that hard drive and go down to Studio X with the biggest Pro Tools setup in the world, or over to Microsoft Studios, or to Europe, and be pretty well assured that they're going to have a big Pro Tools system there that I can immediately, you know, plug my hard drive into their system and have it show up, with one minor exception. Pro Tools 10 sessions will not open on older systems. That's something they kind of gloss over when you first get the thing, which is if you want to work in Pro Tools 9 or earlier, you have to save your session as an earlier version. And they give you an option to do that. It's really easy to do, but you have to think ahead a little bit. So if you know you're going to another studio to work, just save two versions. Save one in Pro Tools 10 version, save one in Pro Tools 9 or earlier, and you're golden. There is no way to transcode that session once it's saved. So, yes?
Do you know if they're going to do that? That 10 and 11 will be compatible in both directions, going from 32 to 64?
I'm going to answer that the way I'm going to answer all Pro Tools 11 questions tonight, which is Avid knows and only Avid knows. And I wish I had a look into the crystal ball, but like I said, they're not even in beta yet on 11. So I can't answer a lot. We know, we think we know it's a couple things about 11. We think we know it's going to be a 64-bit program, which is going to have massively better use of RAM, and it'll be much faster. But things like that, you know, faster than real-time bounces, who knows? We've been asking for these things for years. It remains to be seen whether or not... Oh, Keisha's here to make sure I tell the truth.
I will say that Media Composer, which is now 64-bit, in 6.0 they did not, but with 6.5 they did upgrade it so that it will talk to 5, but not below that.
So Pro Tools, the reason that's critical is Pro Tools and Media Composer are getting closer and closer together as programs. You used to have to get back and forth using an OMF file transfer. If you were a video editor working in Media Composer, you would have to export an OMF file in order to get your session to open in Pro Tools. They're working towards a seamless integration whereby you can have people on the same team working off the same sessions using the same session data, so that if you've got a post-production house, you can have your video editors and your audio editors working on the same material without having to duplicate files. So that's a big part of it. Thank you for bringing that up. Where are we now? Oh, we're on this time.
How do you lock multiple machines together with programs?
That's really... Okay, yeah, this is a good time for me to talk about the Grammys for a minute. How many of you guys watch the show? Fair amount. Okay. Did you like it? Yeah?
Yeah.
It had I felt the same way. Yeah. In general, it was a pretty good show. And for me, a good show means that nothing crashed and we didn't lose anybody's microphone and you heard all the stuff you were supposed to hear. The way the Grammys work is very interesting. I'll describe briefly how they run the show and then talk about how they do all of the technical parts. If you watch the Grammys, you'll see that the stage is giant. It's, you know, 200 feet across, divided into three sections, the center section where the stairs are, and a stage left and a stage right side. They only run two numbers in the whole 3.5-hour show. They only run two numbers that use the entire width of the stage. That's the opening number and the finale. The reason being, they can preset the opening number, and they've got all this time, and they don't have to clean up after the finale, so they can, you know, have the biggest numbers bookend the show. But in between, every act gets its own stage. So while act number two is playing on stage left, they're presetting everything on stage right. So they've got set pieces, they've got everything that they roll out on stage, and they've got these giant mil-spec huge mic connectors that they'll plug in all the microphones. And then backstage, there's a switching network, so they can route all of the mic cables to the various splits that they need, because they've got a monitor on stage left, monitor on stage right, they've got a front of house mix, and then it gets split and goes up to the recording trucks. That's where I work, in the music mix trucks. So they've got all of these presets going on, and it's a 3.5-hour show with very few commercial breaks. So you kind of have to get your logistics down pretty tightly. The way it works during Grammy week, the show is on Sunday. Rehearsals start on Wednesday. They're loading in for 10 days prior to the telecast. They've got riggers hanging stuff from the ceiling. They've got 160 tons of gear hanging just for the auditorium. It's a 15,000-seat auditorium, so they've got all these, you know, all the staging and all the cameras that they bring in, 18 cameras, and there's 180 stagehands and 150 technicians, and 49 audio people, 30-some video people. I mean, it's really tremendous. It's the biggest music show on television. So rehearsals start on Wednesday. Each band gets an hour and a half on stage. Each act that you see gets an hour and a half on stage. And in this hour and a half, they have to get their staging right. Everything has to come to the right place on the stage. They've got to mark where they're going to stand. They've got to get the lighting right. They have to get the TV cameras to be in the right place, on the right people at the right time. The performers, obviously, have to get their part right. The audio people have to get their monitor mixes together. And then in the music mix truck, we've got to make sure that we've got a telecast mix that's album quality that can go out on the air to 30 million people. We've got an hour and a half for each act to do this. So the question is, how do you do that, especially when it's bam, 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 band after band, switching back and forth? The way they work it is they have two identical mobile trucks side by side. In the A truck, they're working with the act that's on stage. They're recording video and audio to two Pro Tools systems, redundant systems. They're mixing on a control or D command, which is the bigger one?
Control.
Control? Okay. Yeah, they've got a 48-channel D control, which is an $80,000 mouse, basically. What? I'm not a factory guy.
It's more than a mouse.
Yes, it is more than a mouse. It has pretty lights. It has Vegas mode. My mouse doesn't have Vegas mode. But it works really well for this system. I mean, it's perfectly suited for the way they do this. And they have redundant Pro Tools systems running for this mixer. There is no recording done on through that console. It's merely a mixer. So all of the audio comes up from the stage. It's routed to the recorders along with the video from the HD cameras. The audio is passed through the Pro Tools system that's running the mixer, and it's just a mixer. At that point, there's no automation done, but they are able to do all of their levels and processing and presets and save that as a snapshot. So when the band first comes up, they can have a snapshot that comes up and they're ready to go for the first act. So they usually run the number three or four times. The band will then have to relinquish the stage to the next act. But that's where they have network drives. They copy all the data over to the B truck, and they continue working. So the mix team from band number two walks over to the B truck, and they continue working for the next hour and a half while a new band is doing its sound check and recording all of their material in the A truck. So you have the assembly line where you have two music mix teams that are trading back and forth constantly until they get this thing right. And nobody can go over. I mean, this is a union operation. They have to be off the stage by 10 o'clock at night. So they literally have an hour and a half in one truck, then they refine for an hour and a half. And the band reps usually come up. This year we had Jack White in the truck, and I forget who else came up. A couple of years ago when Mick Jagger was performing, he came up to the truck. It's interesting to see who really cares about how they're going to sound on the air. If the front of house guy shows up, you know they kind of care. And if the artist shows up, you know they really care. So we had Jack White and I forget who else, Maroon 5 I think came up. But then they take the next hour and a half and they refine all of the cues. And they've got the video recorded and they've got the audio recorded from four run-throughs. They take the best, most representative take, and they'll work that for an hour and a half until they get all of the processing right, all the delays, all the reverbs, all of the panning. It's all mixed in surround, all the levels, and then they'll store that as presets. But all of the mixes are done live. You can't automate a live mix, right? Because what if the drummer clicks off at, a couple of clicks slower? So everything is done mixed live. So I'm part of, as my job as part of the mix team, is I'm up with the music mixer, the union guy who's actually got his hands on the console calling cues. Here comes this part of the song, here comes that thing. And we run this thing for an hour and a half until we get it perfectly right, and then switch back to the other truck and start over again with a new act. And this happens constantly from Wednesday through Saturday night. On Sunday morning, we have a full dress rehearsal at 10 o'clock. We run through the entire show in costume, with pyro, with everything, and we get one chance to get that right, and because at 5 o'clock, it's live to 30 million people. We had an interesting thing happen this year. Mumford & Sons came on stage for their rehearsal, and they rehearsed for an hour and a half, and they picked their song. It was, a really good song, and they did a great job at it. And they walked off stage, came in the truck, and listened, and they went, "We're not going to do that number. We just spent 3 hours working on this, and there's no more rehearsal time, to practice getting everything down again." And they said, "Oh, and by the way, we're going to do a different number, and we're going to add three horn players." So we're going, okay. So what happened was we cut a little bit of extra time in the dress rehearsal on Sunday morning, We brought up the horn players, got them all line checked, and they came out and had two run-throughs to get it right. And then that space between 1:30 and 4:30 to refine the mix to get it right. And I don't know if any of you saw the Mumford's segment. It was pretty good. It was pretty tight. But that's a tribute to that crew, you know, how you can get this incredibly complex machine to turn on a dime. I mean, you're talking camera moves are plotted out weeks in advance, and these guys turned it around pretty quickly, and no one was the wiser. No one knew anything otherwise. Justin Timberlake, in the Justin Timberlake number, Jay-Z came out and halfway through, and he did his little rap thing. He didn't show up for any of the rehearsals. When he got there for the show, he wouldn't do a sound check. He wouldn't even go check 1-2-1-2. He wouldn't touch the microphone. He wanted it to be completely spontaneous so that when he walked out on stage, it was going to be fresh and raw, and the audio team was going, oh my God, what are we going to do? Because, you know, he holds his microphone like this, and we didn't know what we were going to get. So fortunately, we had a couple of our crew people go out and do a test, pretty loud cupped microphone, 58 wireless, and got a little bit of a line test on it so that when he came out, you know, the mixers are ready, you know, we're ready to do whatever is necessary. And seamless, just fit right in. You know, thank goodness he went out there and hammered it. If he had gone out there and... you wouldn't have heard him. So that was, you know, a little bit of sweating behind the scenes that nobody saw. The technical part that almost went sideways on us, we were 30 seconds to Justin Timberlake, and the stage manager goes, mute Justin's microphone. And we go, why? And I said, because we have to replace a battery. And we're going, uh-oh, this isn't good. He has his own Audio Technica mic. Oops. His own microphone that he uses, and they were having problems with it recognizing the lithium-ion battery that they put in it. It doesn't necessarily give you the true readout of the power, apparently, and so they looked at it, and it said low, so they said, oh, we have to replace this. They replaced it, and apparently they replaced it with a battery that was dead. So now we're 5 seconds to air. They're announcing Justin Timberlake, and this mic is completely dead. So fortunately, they have a spare that they keep on the edge of the stage, and they literally tossed it to him just in time for him to go. So we all lost a little bit of weight that day.
But. Was it the same brand of mic? Was the spare?
No, the spare worked.
So yeah.
Sorry, did I say that in my outside voice? Oh God, Rick, you're supposed to stop me from saying that.
Say,
yeah.
Have they ever thought about getting like a behind the scenes documentary of the Grammys to show all this stuff?
We've been trying to get them to do that for a couple of years now. If have you any of you had the backstage tour at the Grammy? You ever been down there? Keisha has. She could probably give the backstage tour now. It is one of the most interesting things you'll ever see if you're at all technically inclined. If you get an opportunity to see the Grammys, I took a group of students and trustees and other folks, about a dozen people, on a backstage tour this year, and it's just fascinating. I mean, the logistics of putting that show together. I mean, just from an audio standpoint. Are really mind-boggling, but you look at all the staging that goes on. You look at they have over a dozen video trucks that are there to supply all the programming, and simultaneously, while we're doing this at Staples Center, across the street is Nokia Theater, where they're doing the pre-tell. So out of 81 awards that we give out during the Grammys, 11 or 12 of them make it on the air on the telecast that you see at home. The rest are given out in what's called the pre-tell or the pre-telecast. Which is for the first year held at Nokia Theater. So there's an entirely separate but equally daunting presentation going on at the Nokia Theater. And so they have their own video trucks, they've got their own audio crew, their own, you know, and there were 5,000 people in attendance this year. Really amazing. I mean, the logistics of what's going on are really astounding. And you kind of get lost in Grammy world during that week. And because, you know, it's its own city. There are so many people that are there just concentrating on this. And last anecdote, and then I'll actually move back to Pro Tools. Last year, halfway through the dress rehearsal, we noticed SWAT teams around. We didn't know what was going on. We just noticed, you know, there's all these people with with guns. And I talked to a person on the security crew, and they said, watch out if you're crossing the street between the Nokia Theater and Staples. And I said, why? I said, well, keep an eye on the rooftop. They've got snipers up on the rooftop. And we're going, okay, that's new for Grammy Week. As it turns out, they caught some guy making a dry run. You'll never read about this in the news. They caught some guy making a dry run, placing empty boxes at various places around the LA Live complex, who was apparently planning to use the real thing later in the day. But they caught this guy jumping a fence, and so they thought they weren't going to take any chances, so they put SWAT teams around. And, you know, what they won't do to get even with Chris Brown. I swear. But anyways, see, this all started with Pro Tools, and now I'm talking about gun control. So to wrap up the discussion about Pro Tools, they're operating four systems in each mix truck. Two to record and playback audio and video, two to run the mixer. Some of you are asking, have you ever had a Pro Tools system go down in the middle of a show? Yes, we did. We once had the mixer, first the number one Pro Tools system for the mixer, actually hung up in one of the scene changes. And you get about 6 or 7 minutes of commercials, and you've got to make this giant scene change. And in this particular instance, there was two bands back-to-back because there was no commercial break. So you have to do essentially two complete setups so that you can, you know, because it takes too long to load a second setup. You can't go from band one to band two and immediately load a new session. It takes 3 or 4 minutes to load a big session. So they had this thing ready to go, and halfway through loading up, it just got the spinning beach ball of death. And fortunately, there was the redundant system, so they simply rerouted the console to the other Pro Tools rig, and they were up and running. But, I mean, once again, we were literally listening to the announcer go, and now, ladies and gentlemen, the Grammy stage is proud to bring you, and we're watching, you know, the loading bar. And, you know, I forget who, you know, Justin Timberlake, and it went boom, and all the faders flew up, and we're like, okay. By the hair on our chinny chin chins. Yes.
Is the only reason that you record for the refinement sessions and maybe CYA in case the band gets hit by a truck? I have some stage hands up there playing the air guitar and
really?
Run the track.
Yeah, just do it all in silhouette. Yeah. You know, that's not happened yet. They haven't had to do that. Have someone not show up. Fortunately, you know, knock on whatever substance this is. What they do is, if you're watching the telecast, you'll see these promos. They'll say, "Coming up, Rihanna, Mumford and Sons, and so on and so forth." And they're playing the band footage, video footage, and audio of the band doing the number that they're going to do. But that information, that data, comes from the rehearsal. So they use it for promos throughout the show, and even the day before, they'll take rehearsal footage and they'll run it for all of these promos. So they use it for that. But there was one instance where, if you're watching on the East Coast, it's live. It goes up at 5 o'clock Pacific time. But we don't get it here until 8 o'clock Pacific time. So it's on a delay. A couple of years ago, Bon Jovi played with... Who's that girl? Jennifer Nettles, thank you. They were singing a song, and the guitar player, Richie Sambora, got to a part in the song and forgot what he was supposed to do. And he either sang a line wrong or played the guitar part wrong or something. He missed a cue pretty badly. So on the East Coast, they heard that. But the band, everybody knew that this was a problem. So what they did is they went back to the rehearsal take, and for the West Coast delayed broadcast, they cut that part out of the rehearsal section, and they edited it in so that the West Coast folks heard, you know, the perfect version. They asked Richie later, you know, what was the deal? Why did you miss that? And he goes, well, Jennifer Nettles was standing right in front of me, and she looks pretty good from the back. So. That was his story, and he stuck to it. So that's the only practical application of that so far. Last Grammy story, I hope. There was a big all-star medley a couple of years ago. They were singing a John Lennon song, and it got to Stevie Wonder's part. It was all, you know, everybody was up there on stage, and it got to Stevie Wonder's part, and there's a, you know, it's a famous Beatles song, and everybody's singing along, and Stevie Wonder forgot the words. So he just kind of went, na 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 na. And so they pulled him up in the truck between shows. They had him re-sing the line. And so for the West Coast broadcast, there was Stevie Wonder singing the Beatles song. It's like overdubs on the Grammys. But I must say that all the vocals are live. You'll hear, you'll see posts everywhere and people saying, oh, you know, the Grammy vocals were canned and it's all pre-recorded. It's not. All the lead vocals are live.
Nobody would can those off-key vocals.
Why would you? Just to prove?
Or.
So background vocals aren't live?
Some of the background vocals are on Pro Tools. And I think they actually do have lead vocals just in case something happens, like a mic drops out or, you know, singer falls off the stage or something like that. So they do have that stuff on Pro Tools for playback, but very few track acts in the Grammys. They try to get all the bands to play live. I mean, you expect professionals to be able to do that kind of stuff.
So they're playing that back in real time as they're performing
it? Yes. A lot of the acts that are playing with Pro Tools tracking them, they have a click track on the Pro Tools rig that's feeding the drummer. Right. So it's got the count off so that everybody's in the right place so that, you know, the verse is where the verse is supposed to be. Did they perform that year?
I don't know.
Did they ever perform? I don't know. Did they ever perform? That's a really good question. Well, I mean, you know, come on, Beyonce at the, excuse me, the inauguration. What's that?
Playback by Ampex that year, wasn't it?
Was it's
well,
entirely possible.
Pro Tools existed, so.
Yeah, it's entirely possible. Yes.
There's four systems in each of 12 trucks.
Each of two audio trucks.
Oh, two audio trucks.
Right.
So there's eight systems, and what the hardware look like for each of those systems?
They're using the HDX stuff. I take that back. They're running Pro Tools 10 on HDTDM systems. And the reason they're doing that is because they use Waves plugins, and Waves has not yet ported for AAX, and it remains to be seen whether they will. And they can't use RTOS, Real-Time Audio Suite plugins, because the latency is too great. They have a rule for the telecast, no more than 400 samples of delay. So whether it's a reverb, they can't use convolution reverbs because the delay is too great. But whether it's a delay or, you know, whatever kind of plugin you may want to use, if it has more than 400 samples, they can't use it. So if the truck decides to go to Pro Tools 11 next year, hopefully Waves will release AAX versions of their plugins, or, you know, they'll have to find substitutes. But yeah,
they're talking about native, but they're not talking. Now they've come up with their own hardware to offload stuff
right
through a server. So, I don't know. It doesn't look good.
Yeah, you never know. I mean, there are a lot of other digital console manufacturers out there that would love to have their console in the trucks. And so they're looking at it. Every year they get pitched for new gear, and it remains to be seen what's in the truck from year to year. Yeah.
Your 400 samples latency, I assume, is aggregate for everything you're using, not just 400 samples per plugin.
Yes, but because of the delay compensation built into Pro Tools, it automatically sets the entire system delay to the delay of the longest plugin. It's not aggregated across, you know, 48 tracks. It takes the longest delay.
Worst
and
case.
Yeah. And no, I think there's some, what's that?
No convolution reverb.
Right, no convolution reverb.
So
it's just
worst case
too great.
Has to be 400 samples.
Yes. So the longest delay of any single plugin.
Is that to synchronize accurately with their video? Or
yes. They notice that things start to slide a little bit when you see, you know, when it starts to look like a kung fu movie. CBS has a problem with that. Yes?
And so the four systems, I think you said two are doing recording, two are doing mixing?
Yes.
And that corresponds with stage A, stage B?
No, actually, during the telecast, it's all run off of one truck. The A truck is entirely dedicated to the telecast. But the B truck is tracking as well. So once again, while band A is performing and the A truck is mixing, in the B truck, they're doing line checks for the next act. So everything is lined up and duplicated so that if for some reason the act starts up in the A truck and the mixer goes down, they can immediately switch over to the B truck and have everything right there because they've just done the line checks.
You get a switch and yeah. You're on the other truck.
Literally. Yeah, you know, thank goodness we haven't had to do that yet. But.
And so there's no analog plugs. It's all going on with waves on that mixer and inserts on the channels. That's how they're making the sound.
Yes, yeah, there's no hardware inserts on those systems. They do use a lot of the Avid plugins, the Digirack stuff.
Sure.
The EQs primarily, because they're so low overhead in terms of latency, they're almost instantaneous. I mean,
no
four samples or something.
Or
no.
Just preamps.
Yeah. You know, the overall audio mix happens in a different truck. I'm just talking about the music mix. The overall mix for telecast happens in a different truck. It's called Denali. It's their HD TV truck that they send all, you know, for, they just finished the Super Bowl the week before. So then the truck comes up to LA and they have the master control for video switching in this truck. Then they have a section for all of the audio where they take the music mix that we send them. And they take all of the bumper elements, all of the promos, all of the announcers, all of the voiceovers, all of the live microphones on stage, and all of these, and the there's also another individual engineer doing a house applause mix, right? So they have 35 microphones placed around the bowl, and there's somebody mixing all of this together in surround as well. And so Tom, oh, I blanked on his last name. There's a guy named Tom who does the overall mix for the telecast, and he takes all of these elements. He's got a big SSL console, and he does use some outboard gear, but that's an analog console, so that's the last stage before the uplink. My job during the telecast, when I wasn't assisting on the three or four numbers that I worked on, I was in the B truck monitoring the feed that went to the satellite uplink that goes to New York. And then typically they'll send us a backhaul so that we can compare the uplink to the backhaul to see if there's any loss in quality. In the meantime, I've got a half a dozen engineers on the Eastern Seaboard who are watching the show in real time, and we've got a chat room open, and they're telling me if they hear any problems or if there are dropouts or things of that nature, or if the mix is funny. And they're monitoring in both stereo and surround.
What are they using for front of house in the hall?
JBL Vertec. And the Yamaha digital console? Rick?
Is there a designated auto-tune operator?
The only time I've seen auto-tune used on the show is Black Eyed Peas. And you could hear it.
Chris Brown.
Chris Brown did too? Oh, okay. Yeah.
And it was intentional.
Yeah, whenever it's on the record, you know, whenever it's an effect that you hear on the record. Yeah.
Rather than remedial vocal.
Yeah. No, none of that. None of the.
Did you watch the Grammys, Rick?
No,
they did not use auto tune.
Are you referring to a particular act?
Pardon?
Are you referring to a particular?
Well, actually,
act
quite a few early, and then at the end, Frank Ocean was horrible. It was just amazing.
That's his thing, man.
And I hope that it was that his monitors were bad, but I don't know.
He was consistently bad.
He was consistently off.
Yeah. Are you saying his monitors were off too?
Say he couldn't hear himself.
Be
the delay.
Yeah, that's it. I've actually seen somebody do that with pitch in a live situation to mess with somebody, but you send it back to him and you keep making it lower and lower, so you have to sing higher and higher. There's a special hell for engineers who do that. I'm just saying, it's a special award. So okay, well, Rick, you were supposed to stop me from going down the rabbit hole, but the Grammy rabbit hole.
It was too good to stop.
So if you have any other questions about the Grammys, I'm your guy. But we're here to talk about this thing, this year Pro Tools thing.
Before it changes to a button.
What? That's not what I want.
It's not a gigantic leap.
Yeah. It is, but I want... Oh, there we go. Play. Huh. Duh. What? That's not what I want.
I'll just click on its slide.
Yeah. Fine. Really? This worked last night.
Are you running out of Windows?
I can't even spell PC. Well, heck. All right, fine.
Should we call the other PowerPoint truck?
Where's my redundant PowerPoints? No, that's just not nice. See, when I hit this thing yesterday, it went poof, and I had this big thing that was...
Goes poof now?
Yeah, it went poof all
right.
Yeah, okay. Welcome to my world. Okay. Anybody know what I'm doing wrong?
Just click on the slide to the left and go for
it. Yeah, okay. Slide to the left. Pro Tools 10 is a gigantic leap in sound and speed. And thank you to the Avid marketing team for that. But it actually is. This is, you know, one time where they really had a point here. So I'm going to walk you through an overview of what changed in Pro Tools 10. And how many of you guys are still on 9 or earlier? And how many are on 10? Okay, so for a lot of you, this might seem redundant, but I'll try to cover things to make it interesting. Used to be if you had a 16-bit file or a 44.1 or 48K file, it had to be copied over before it could be added to your session. And was it something I said? Yeah. It was the Grammy thing, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Was it?
I'm sorry.
It was the PowerPoint presentation.
It was the PowerPoint. Curse you, Microsoft. I'm not making any friends with the manufacturers today. Now you can incorporate multiple bit rates and sample rates in your same session without having to copy the files over. You can if you want. You can in the preferences, you can say, force everything to comply with whatever my file format standard is for this particular session. But it makes things a lot faster, particularly if you've got giant files that, an entire movie soundtrack that you're trying to bring in or something like that. It makes work a lot faster. Also, previously, Pro Tools would not handle interleaved files. If you brought in a stereo file that was in an interleaved format, it would have to copy that file, separate it into two component mono files, and then add it to the audio files folder. Now it just, if you drag in the stereo interleaved file, it will treat it as an interleaved file and play back accordingly. You can do the same with your recordings. If you used to record a stereo piano track, for example, it would record two mono files, and they would live under a separate ID in your audio files folder. Now, if you select in preferences when you're building your session, I want to make this an interleaved session, anytime you record a stereo audio file, it will live as an interleaved file. Why is that cool? Well, aside from the fact that you don't have to go looking for two files when you want to find something, if you want to share an interleaved file with somebody, you don't have to do a 35-minute bounce to create an interleaved file. It's already there in interleaved file format. So in terms of speed, absolutely. I mean, it saves tons of time for people doing long-form work.
And multi-channels are also interleaved. It doesn't just...
Oh, right. Sorry. Yeah, 5.1 or 7.1 files as well. Record and mix using 32-bit floating-point files, which is something that the other workstations have done for quite some time, but now Pro Tools has finally figured out how to do the math and make the program run at the same time. Many of the most requested features, some of the most requested features, improved disk scheduling, disk cache, and real-time fades. In English, what that means is Pro Tools now loads your session into RAM as much as possible. So whereas before you had to have these really cool hard drives,
careful.
which we all use faithfully, you had to run your session off of those drives. There was no choice because you had to have a drive that had an Oxford 911 chip with a really fast throughput so that you could get enough audio in and out of the thing to keep error codes from coming up on your computer and stopping your session. Well, we still use the really cool hard drives for sessions, But now, if you have to bring in additional elements, or if you're working on your laptop, you don't need to necessarily use the fastest FireWire drives. Now, you can run a session off a thumb drive if you need to. I don't suggest it, because it's going to limit your throughput, and you won't have the number of tracks that you would with a really fast drive. But you can run a session mostly in RAM now without having to have a giant hard drive attached. Yes?
Is that just HD, or is that all Pro Tools 10?
I'm not running HD now.
Yeah.
Yes, Brian.
We ran into a situation where we believed what you said, and when you have a very large session and it caches into RAM and there isn't enough RAM, it lays back to the drives, and if you built your system with slower drives, then you get a problem where you can't add the tracks, and you didn't buy the faster drives.
Right.
So we thought we'd be totally toast, and then we found we were a little...
No. There is no substitute for running your session on a fast drive. Yeah, you. In case you can't see the logo, there's a really great local supplier of these drives, and I suggest that you spend your money on a really solid drive for tracking. What's that? Brian, what type of drive is this?
They're all Seagates. They're all 7400, and the chipset is 934, 944. We named them 911 Plus because Digi, in their infinite wisdom, said it must be at least this. And then when we changed it to a 22 or 24, people got confused, so we just made it Plus. And we keep on integrating faster and faster chipsets. And these are now... they were originally IDEs, now they're SATA drives.
Oh, interesting. Question.
So would a solid-state drive be more advantageous in this realm of speed?
Yep. Much faster, fabulously expensive.
Yeah.
And not any more mechanically sound.
No.
You mean if you dropkick it? Yeah.
You're still toast.
Yeah.
I've also come to understand that some of the solid-state drives have rewrite issues. And that they start to lose data after a certain number of rewrites. I don't have the hard data. I'm sorry?
That's handy.
Yeah, that's handy.
I don't have the hard data. I like that.
Yeah.
I got it.
Yeah. But I lost it. I mean, let's talk about backup right now. I'm going to jump around a little bit.
It's not in three places. It's not backed up.
Yeah. Your favorite IT person will tell you, data isn't data unless it lives in three places. And I'm going to modify that to say in three different formats. Anybody remember SCSI?
Yeah.
How many of you guys use SCSI today? Everett. You poor thing. We got to talk, Everett.
My radar.
Yeah. Right, yeah, exactly.
Well, your SANs, it's turned into an IT-based thing called iSCSI. So your SANs and stuff are operating off of a network using iSCSI. So yes, we're still using it today. It's just this method of connectivity has changed drastically.
Right, and the fact that we used to have these SCSI drives with dedicated SCSI drivers, and then you'd have to boot your system down in order to change drives or add drives or subtract drives, that has all changed. But if you have a drive that you used 10 years ago, 15 years ago, and you don't have the driver card for it, the SCSI card for your computer, you're going to have a hard time getting that information back. You can probably find somebody with a card that's,
an ATTO card.
An ATTO card, yeah, that's stored somewhere, mothballed, or you can take the drive out of its enclosure and try to get it to work in a different system.
If it wasn't rated, you were fine. If it was a single pass drive on it, the SCSI 3 or something, and you're running on like a dev tech, you could do it. But if you're going off on something where you've got a rated system or hotspot system or something like that, no.
Pro Tools, before this, was never set up to do anything but a dedicated
single drive.
Couldn't really pay.
Yeah,
it wouldn't record. No.
I'm just laughing
because
everyone on this other
room
is like, what?
What? SCSI what? SCSI was a really popular interface for hard drives, starting in the 80s. Yeah, well, okay. But if you bought a Pro Tools rig, an HD, well, they didn't have HD at the time, but if you bought a Mix Plus or a really high-end Pro Tools rig, you had to run SCSI hard drives, which means you had to have a dedicated controller card and special SCSI interface hard drives that had the kind of throughput that you needed to be able to do a session with high track counts.
Rabbit hole.
Okay. So now we use FireWire drives. We can use USB drives with Pro Tools 10. and it makes things a lot faster. Okay, yay. Clip gain adjustments. How many of you guys use clip gain? Yeah, two thumbs up. Loving that. Have you seen clip gain? Those of you who didn't raise your hands, have you seen it? You know what we're talking about? You know, when you get a track from somebody that you have to mix, and you know, you've got a comped vocal track, and take one is just like really perfect in level, and take two is minus 20, and take three is minus 12, and take four is oversaturated, and you've got all these different levels on various takes. It's a problem because you're trying to set a compressor, for example, or the rest of your signal chain for a certain to respond to a certain amount of gain. Well, before clip gain, you kind of had to take all of your really quiet tracks and put them on one track, and your really loud tracks and put them on another track, and then do your signal processing, your dynamics processing, based on the amplitude of the signal that you've got on each track. Or you had to rebounce the track and increase the gain or normalize or something like that. Now with clip gain, you can do what's essentially real-time normalization. You can just grab the little clip gain fader on the file and increase or decrease it so that the amplitude of the file is right where you want it. So if your average level is minus 12 and that's where you want it, you take the files that are minus 6 and you bring them down to minus 12. You take the files that are minus 30 and you bring them up to minus 12. So now your entire signal path, your dynamics processing, all responds to signal that's roughly the same level. So, I mean, that's huge just from a music mixer point of view. Yeah.
Also, I just had a project I was doing for Steve on a voiceover.
Uh-huh.
And I discovered that in clip gain, there's something called inline, where they create nodes, so you can just move the nodes up and down, so
yep.
You don't affect the entire clip, just the section that you want to affect, you can just move it up
yep.
and down, so you can, you know, fluctuate.
It's like another layer of automation.
Mm-hmm. That doesn't move in time. It stays with it.
That lives with the clip.
Yeah, because when you'd automate levels, and you'd do an edit, because someone would want to change, now everything's in the wrong place.
Not always. Sometimes.
Depends on how
you
do
it. No, it usually sticks with it, doesn't it, the automation?
There's one way to do it so it works, and one
right.
way to do it so it
works. Yes, exactly.
Usually when I do clips, I'm almost surprised because I'll go back to the automation and I'll realize that it, like, copied over, like, moved it over or something. I don't know.
Yeah, you can set it up in the preferences.
It's in 10 or something, yeah.
You can set it up in the preferences so that the automation moves with the edit.
Right.
So that it's linked. But you can also disable that, which can be problematic. I found that when you've got a track with a lot of edits, with a pretty high edit density, and you start to move automation around and it's complex automation, a lot of times those moves will get lost. And so using clip gain, that information, that automation data that you've written with the nodes lives with that clip. So no matter where you put it, even if you've got, you know, every 15 milliseconds, you know, an edit, that clip gain information lives with that clip, no matter where you put it.
And that's just down on the bottom left-hand corner.
Yeah. Let me...
No, it's in... you have to go in view and get it, because it's not in the clip. Actually, the clip...
You got to show it. It doesn't...
Sorry. It's like... What was the quote? Talking about music is like dancing about architecture. Unless you see it. Everybody gives that quote to Thelonious Monk, but I think it was...
Whatever the internet decides.
Yeah. George Washington, I think, is said first.
I see if you had a solid-state drawing in there, we wouldn't
have... Yeah, well, this is where I do the song and dance. So, how about that lovely purple logo? Those of you who are paying attention will notice that I'm not using 10.3.3. I'm using 10.2 because I don't want to do other upgrades to my system in order to use 10.3.3. Plus, it's rock solid. Plus, I've been so busy that I haven't had a chance to do it. So that's my story.
They destroyed DigiDesign as a name and kept Pro Tools because they found that more people recognize Pro Tools as what this is than DigiDesign.
Really?
Absolutely.
Easier to pronounce.
That's interesting.
While we're harping, you can say the reason 11 isn't out is because they just reorganized the company.
Yeah, new cheese.
New boss.
Yeah, new cheese.
Would you mind telling them about that, since you know so much?
Well, all I know is that I got an email, you know, from the new president of the Navit saying, the old guy's out, but he's really going to stay for a couple more months because we couldn't fire him outright, but we can't say that.
Yeah.
But I'm the new guy, and we're going to make some changes around here. Have a good day.
And I've been here a while.
So yeah, and I've been here a while.
And the hope is that those changes will be very positive.
Well,
so there you have it. Hey.
It's a big boat. Hard time to steer.
So I just pulled up a session. This is a session that my UW class recorded last week. We brought in a drummer, Jason Edwards, who's a brilliant local drummer, and we had him play to a pre-recorded track and set up a bunch of different microphones. And so what you see here is the session in all of its glory.
Show us the
clip. Yeah, I'm looking for an opportunity to bring something up, but everything was recorded pretty well. So. Okay, so let's just pick one here. Let me grab the kick drum track. And if you look in the lower left-hand corner of the track, you'll see a little teeny tiny fader, and it's right now it says 0 dB.
Yep, that's turned on.
Right. So under, under view, if you go to clip and then clip gain info, I can turn that on. And as to your point about creating the nodes and treating it like automation, if I turn on clip gain line, now all of a sudden I have a line that I can create and edit. Ooh, fancy. Right? So let's say for the sake of discussion that the kick drum was overmodulated. We recorded it too hot and I need to bring it down in order to make my processing work. Rather than go into the automation window and just bring the playback level down, which doesn't change the size of the waveform or tell me how loud it is, I can go over here to the clip gain line or the clip gain control, grab this little fader here, and I can change the gain of the actual audio being played back on that track. So if it's too loud, I bring it down. Guess what? The waveform gets smaller. Hey, there's a concept. It looks smaller, therefore it must be quieter. Conversely,
make it look smaller but not quieter.
Yeah, I can do that too, but it's a little harder. Actually, there's a button for that. There's a button for everything. Yeah, and if I make it louder, the amplitude goes up and the waveforms get bigger too.
When it shows clipping there, is it actually clipping?
Do you want to find out?
Yes.
All right. So here's a well-recorded kick drum track, and I'm just going to... You might want to turn this down a little bit, Rick, because it's going to... You ready? So that there be clipping.
People work hours to get that sound.
And see how much time I've saved you already. One little fader move, yeah. Yeah.
The readout, like if it's -6 or whatever it says, if you set those all the same, are they all going to be the same on different tracks?
No.
Did I?
I'm not sure I follow you.
Yeah. Steve, you want to clarify what I was trying to say?
Sorry. Well, siento, señor, no.
If you make all the clip gains -12, are they really all -12? And the answer is no.
The energy is different.
The energy is different. So you have to actually go into the auto suite and find out what the gain
is.
It's
a relative change, not an absolute value.
Yes, okay. Depending on the amplitude of the signal as recorded.
The picture is what's real.
Right. So if you look at it and if they look roughly the same size, they will be roughly the same amplitude. I mean, this is not a science. They haven't developed a meter, you know, and it's a dynamic performance anyway.
I was wondering if it was actually analyzing it and giving a readout of what the actual amplitude was.
Well, I mean, it'll tell you on the meter. Right? I mean, if I took a sine wave and increased or decreased the clip gain, the meter would certainly tell you, although this one is a little hard to read, but if you pulled up a Doro meter or something with higher resolution, you could certainly get a very precise readout. Yes?
So, you add like a break in the clip, and in the second break, if you make a change to the amplitude, is it going to do the same thing for the second clip?
Well, what I've just done is taken this kick drum track and I've cut it into three pieces. The piece in the middle, I'm going to reduce the amplitude by taking the clip gain down. You see what happens?
So it's by region.
She wants to know if the other region that's a copy of that later in the session also changes.
No,
when you change
they're entirely independent. This is not...
Actually, if you click the button underneath the selector tool, then they do change.
Click the button underneath the selector tool?
Yeah, there's a button underneath the selector tool you don't have.
Oh, right, yeah, a link edit to timeline
thing. Oh, the one next
thing
to that, which is the mirrored editing. Nerd. And when you edit one, edit all of them.
Weird MIDI editing?
Yeah, it's a misnomer now. Well, you should just work on MIDI.
Also, if you copied it 14 times and you make a change in one.
I was under the impression it changed them all.
Yeah, not that one.
That is...
Not that one. It'll work with MIDI, but I haven't seen it work with audio. It's this is not digital performer, right. Where you can't get away from that. But did that answer your question? It kind of came at that sideways, but no. Each edit, each clip is treated independently. Right. Each audio clip. Yes.
I mean, a lot of times I'm trying to imitate automation using this clip gain feature.
Uh-huh.
So I group together a bunch of similar parts, and I want to adjust them as a group. Can't do that.
On separate tracks?
Yeah.
Really?
I mean, I haven't been able to. I mean, maybe I'm doing something wrong. I don't know.
You mean if you consolidate it and make a group?
No, just say you have clip. Four different parts and you want to adjust all those gains. That, you know.
Okay, I've just selected two tracks on two completely different tracks.
And you're using one clip gain to do that?
Yes.
Okay.
And the way I'm doing that, now, I don't think you can do that with the little... Faderette? No, you can't do that with the little fader. But if you show under the view clip gain line,
right?
If you have that line visible,
you can't do it with the fader.
Now I can grab that gain line and change any number of tracks or regions. Sorry? Nope. That's just... okay, you'll notice, wow, we're jumping all over the place. I apologize for that, but I'll try to explain what I'm doing. You see... this little area here where I'm pointing at my screen.
Use your laser pointer.
Okay. See where it says selector tool?
Yeah. Do you have a cursor, right?
I do have a cursor. Right here is my cursor. Where it says selector tool, there is a bar right above this that gangs these three, right? So I can select one of these three tools, or if I click on that little bar above it, it gives me the smart tool, which allows me to select any number of different things within the waveform. So if you follow my cursor down to the track, it's an I-beam tool, which allows me to select a region, or it's a hand tool, which allows me to move a track, or it's if I hover right above the clip gain line, it turns sideways and allows me to adjust the clip gain, much like you would do with automation.
It also lets you do
edge,
oh yes, right, of course. Yeah, and if you hold it on the edge, I can either, you know, truncate or do a crossfade or fade in or out.
It's
so
based upon where it is in the screen.
Correct, depending on where you hold the cursor within the track.
And that's
you
in
get
the book.
And now Brian Cornfield will
page 49.
Oh, that's what you need, a sticky thing.
Yeah, exactly. That's you know, for a while there, I actually was going back to the clip gain section in the book going, now how did I do that? Because if you don't use it on a daily basis, it doesn't really get stuck, for me at least, it doesn't get stuck in my head until I've done it a few times. Everybody learns in a different way. Keisha and I were just talking about this. Everyone has a different style of learning. You know, some people need to read it in a book so that they can really understand it. Some people need to see it on a screen or a video or something. Other folks need it explained. But for me, it all comes together when I've read about it and I can get in front of the screen and actually manipulate it myself. Then it gets stuck in here where I can actually remember having done it. And so I need a reference like this all the time. So I have, you know, the few books that I use, I keep them right next to my workstation so I can go back and check it out. But... yeah, so...
They say if you do something 20 times...
20?
Hey, Glenn.
Yes?
This is probably a silly question, but it probably doesn't introduce any color, but do you find that doing a lot of adjustments of gain, I assume this is like a digital form of gain, I mean, does it do anything to the sound that...
It's rewriting the order.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's like normalizing, and so anytime you normalize something and you increase the gain... you're bringing up all the noise floor, right? And so if you have a new clip gain setting every bar, the noise floor is going to change every bar. So if you have a solo guitar performance and you're changing the clip gain a lot, you're going to hear that noise floor coming up and down in a very unnatural way. So yes, it is changing the character of the playback quality. So I'd be careful about that kind of thing. I mean, if you're doing a mix of something in context where you have a lot of other instruments, you probably won't notice the noise floor changing too terribly much. But in terms of frequency content, not really. You're just making it louder or softer. So
you're writing the digital word.
It does not rewrite.
It's not making a new file.
No, it's rewrite.
When you it's applying that parameter on playback.
Are you not modifying the digital word to when you're rewriting the gain in it?
Yes, but you're not rewriting a file. It's not creating a new file with the clip gain information.
Rendered.
Sorry?
Unless you're rendered.
Unless it's rendered.
Right.
So, yes, it's not rewriting the file. It's merely applying these parameters to playback. I hope that was clear. No. Thank you for making that clear. Clip gain, huge. If any of you do post-production work, that's a giant help in doing sound design or in taking care of field audio. I can't tell you how many times in the last week I've gotten field audio in from a video shoot, and the peak on the audio tracks that they give me is minus 30. You know, the peak, and what do you do with that? You know, you run that through a compressor and you end up with on your entire track. So if I bring the gain up, now I've got something I can work with. I bring it in at 24 bits, but if I increase the gain, now I've got something I can work with. If I have too much background noise that comes up with the track, now I can apply some sort of intelligent noise reduction software to it as a plugin to decrease the noise. So, I mean, there's a million things you can do with it, but I mean, this is such a great help that I just felt like we had to spend an hour on it. So there. What else? 16K ADC setting for bigger mixes with more plugins. Automatic delay compensation has been kind of a tough thing for Pro Tools users who are accustomed to working in Logic or some of the other workstations that in native mode have the ability to have 16,000 samples of delay compensation. On a TDM system, on an HD TDM system, you're only capable of 4,000 some odd samples, which, you know, in the grand scheme of things is not very much delay compensation. So if you have giant plugins, like I use Master X, which is a TC multiband compressor plugin, that's 4,500 or 5,000 samples of delay. So right there, I've exceeded my delay compensation capacity within the program. Now, native users of Pro Tools have 16,000 samples of delay compensation. So now they're competing with Nuendo and Logic and some of the other workstations, which is huge if you stack up a lot of really high overhead plugins. And on native, it's really pretty much necessary because a lot of the waves stuff, particularly the convolution reverbs or the multiband compressors, take that much delay in order to do all of their processing. So that's huge. The only drawback, if you're using a TDM system, you're kind of locked to that 4,000 sample delay compensation setting. With HDX hardware, however, if you make the step up to HDX, then you get 16,000 samples like everybody else. One thing that you'll hear a lot as they talk about new software and migrating platforms is that Pro Tools 10 will be the last software iteration to support HD TDM hardware. Now, that doesn't mean you're not going to be able to use 11 with... Oh, Brian's got an opinion.
No. What we were originally told was it won't support it. Mm-hmm. And then what we were told was they will not test it and qualify it, but there's no reason why a 192 won't work on an HDX card. And in fact, we have several clients that are using Omnis, 192s, whatever they want. It will support it. And 11 will have no change in that. It doesn't care what it's talking to, but they won't support it. So if you have a problem with your $20,000 rig and you call up and say, "Yeah, I'm running a bunch of 192s," they're going to say it's not an approved system.
Right.
The same way the HDX cards don't work in certain processors. They do, but you can't flash them when you need to upgrade them. Mm-hmm. So they're not qualified. But I can plug one into my rig, which is too old, and it'll run HDX. I just can't upgrade. So it's not approved, but it will work. So if you can't make the full leap, you can still run fine.
Exactly. What we found from Pro Tools in the past is DigiDesign had a habit of making sure that their old hardware worked for another year and a half or two or 3 years beyond the last iteration that they promised they would cut it out. And so we're starting to see that now. Some of the legacy interfaces are starting to be phased out to the point where you can't use... can you still use 888s with... yeah.
I believe so.
Yeah.
But the 192s, sonically, compared to the HDX, to the HDIOs, are so much better that it's...
192s compared to HDIO? That's not what I've heard.
Brand new power supplies, brand new A to Ds, brand new D to As. They're substantially better. We don't sell clocks to anybody.
I'm sorry, let me clarify that. The HDIOs sound better than the 192s.
Yes.
Okay, that's not what you said. But
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I agree. I'm hearing that from a lot of people.
Yeah,
is that
people are reluctant to use them. Plus, Digi won't sell you an HDX card without an IO. Nor will they upgrade you without you buying an IO.
Right. So at some point, if you're running an HD TDM rig,
yep,
it will make sense for you to upgrade to HDX if you're doing live overdubs. I make that important distinction because if you're running a native system, if you're a mixer, or if you're doing electronic music, and if you don't have the need for live overdubs, then you don't need the low latency specs that an HDX system will provide. So if you don't want to get HDX, you have two choices. You go native, you can get an Omni interface, or you can go without a dedicated interface, or you can stay on your HD TDM rig. But if you want to stay with the current version of the software or continue to grow with the latest iterations, HDX will take you there. But right now, HD TDM and HDX are the only two systems that I'm aware of on the market that have low enough latency specs that you can reliably do overdubs, synchronizing live performance with pre-recorded tracks without performance latency, and be able to do that accurately with processing. Yes.
So I was told the HDX card, one HDX card is worth about like four or five.
Yeah.
Brian, yeah, thanks. TDM cards.
Excel.
Could it be true? Is
Excel.
That really
yeah,
how much processing is on?
Yeah, and I have to turn in my HD3 for an HDX, and I'll just need one card.
Right.
And it'll have more processing power than
and
it
is. And then you can put multiple HDX cards together for the
sure.
Super waving?
The big fear is that, not from Avid, but the big fear in the audio community and the video community as well, is that Apple is going to stop making towers.
That's why we have Thunderbolt.
So what's been tested lately is Thunderbolt, the little tiny port on the side of your laptop, Thunderbolt adapters that will house an HDX card and sit alongside your laptop so that you can use any computer, whether it's an iMac or whether it's a Mac Mini,
yeah,
or a laptop. And a lot of schools are doing that, actually. They're starting to use Mac Minis or iMacs with these external Thunderbolt cards. And I don't know what the price point is on that, but, I mean, to have the power of an HDX system in a laptop, that's amazing. You can take that with you anywhere and operate it. I mean, it's a truly, you know, unbelievable leap forward in technology. Where was I? Audio suite improvements, including handles and preservation of metadata. Handles are probably the biggest thing for Audio Suite. How many of you folks use Audio Suite right now to process tracks in your session?
Yeah.
Yeah, a couple of folks? Yeah, I mean, it's. How do you use it?
Gain.
Yeah.
For the clip gain.
Right.
Probably don't need that anymore, but anyway.
Like, if you're using Sound Replacer, I'll go up into the Audio Suite.
Sure. Yeah, in game audio production, they'll do a lot of Audio Suite rendering in the session, so that when they spit out their files, they don't have to do another bounce. But the ability exists now to have more than one Audio Suite processor open at a time on your desktop. The ability also exists now to create handles. What I mean by handles are, if we go back to our Pro Tools session here, let's say I've got this thing here, this little region of audio. If I process this with an audio suite plugin in Pro Tools 9, I get a file that's processed that's exactly the same length as this region of audio that I've created. With handles, that gives me the ability to include up to 2 seconds, I believe, on either side of the boundary, so that if I process my file and I go, oh, I cut it right in the middle of a breath, gosh, I wish I'd had the rest of that breath, now I just draw it out and I've got the handles where I can pull out that region and have up to 2 seconds of additional audio. So for any kind of film work or any kind of work, game audio where you're processing files in the session, rewriting new files, that's a real lifesaver. What else do we have that was cool? New channel strip leverages, leverages the System 5 pedigree for all users. This is kind of a marketing thing to a certain extent, but when Avid bought Euphonics, they inherited a lot of their software processing development, which also included this little thing that they call channel strip. Let me change my view here so I can look at this. Plugin, EQ, channel strip, mono. This is a Euphonics plugin that gives you EQ and dynamics all within the same plugin. So channel strip literally means channel strip. Those of you who are accustomed to full-on analog or digital consoles that have built-in dynamics and EQ on each channel, this is what kind of takes the place of that working format. So you can choose any kind of EQ or filtering or noise gates or compressor limiter. You can sidechain these things, and it's all in one fairly low overhead, low delay plugin. I think that for me personally, I tend not to use this a lot, but that's just because of the way I work. I have things that plugins that I use that I'm accustomed to, and it's a little bit hard to see. It's the readout is a little bit small for me. But I also know some people who use Euphonics Series 5 consoles that just love this thing, because if you're running a work surface, for example, you can put one of these on every single channel and treat it like it was a console. You have EQ and dynamics per channel automatically. They build their sessions that way so that it's on every single channel, and you're up and running as though you were working on a regular console.
I've been working that, and I think the EQ is great, but how do you guys like the compression in that channel strip?
It's not, you know, like I said, it's not my favorite plugin, but I tend to use the Focusrite stuff for everyday.
Yeah, I just steered away from it. I couldn't get it to do what I wanted. Pumping and breathing, not transparent. It just didn't have much color, much flavor. I don't know.
Okay, you just said two different things. You want it to be transparent, but it doesn't have enough color.
Yeah, well,
it's a transparent kind of color. I don't want to hear it, but I want it to sound old and
exactly. If I'm hearing you correctly, you want something that's versatile, that can sound transparent when you want it to, and has a personality when you want to have that personality.
Yeah.
Some of the plugins do that. I mean, that's more of a series of artifacts from physical processing devices, from analog processing devices.
SSL buffer has a lot of very cool sound.
Yeah.
Stuff off the SSL 5000.
I'd love to try that. Yeah,
it's very good.
I mean, you can even use the stuff that comes with the basic setup of Pro Tools, the BF76, for example, the 1176 emulator. If you don't hit it too hard, I mean, it's fairly transparent. Sure. But yet you can, you know, go into all buttons in mode, just like an 1176. It'll crush whatever you put through it. And I might even show you how that looks.
Is that a memory hog, though, that channel strip? I mean,
not really.
No? Okay.
I mean, let's find out. Let's just go back to that thing here. Channel strip. Hey, cut that out. Let's not do that. How did I do that? No. Let's go back here and get rid of that. Okay. Whew. All right. So now if I switch to my mix window, if I look at views, mix window views, show me delay compensation, a little window opens up down here in the bottom, and it shows me if I've got delay compensation going on, which I don't have it turned on. So I actually have it turned on before it'll compensate. Figure that one out. All right. So let me turn it on. Delay compensation engine. Look at that. Maximum 32,000 samples per channel. Holy smokes. I'm going for it. I feel lucky. Yeah. Yeah. If you see smoke coming out, look how fast that turned it around. Man, that's just amazing. All right. So now I go over here and I look, and Brian, why isn't it showing any delay compensation?
Because there is no delay required.
Exactly. No, is that it? Because I don't see any on my, I've got BF76 on here too.
Yeah, delay says zero.
Yeah. Interesting.
It's so fast.
It's so fast, it's zero. Yeah, it has overhead. It stores a certain amount of delay for its operation. But if I stick, okay, let's test that theory. Let's go to something ugly like Maxim. Oh, look at that, 2,048 samples. Okay.
So their stuff takes zero?
Yeah, apparently. I don't know how that's possible on a native system. I mean, we're all living this together, right? I mean,
wow. Oh, zero.
Yeah.
Wow. Break.
Break? What are you kidding me? Oh. Yes.
We're on the second slide.
You guys can hang till Sunday, right? We're good.
This isn't Grammys.
I have been reminded that we need a bio break, so let's do that, and we'll reconvene in how long? 15 minutes.
15 years.
I'm going to turn this thing off.